It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll learn about an exchange program that connects Little League baseball players in Puerto Rico and Wisconsin.
First, Western Wisconsin has seen its share of flooding over the last couple of years. Rainstorms that swept through the area last year were so severe, the governor declared a state of emergency.
But over the past year, local officials haven't received their promised federal money from FEMA to repair infrastructure, things like roads and bridges.
Hope Kerwin is a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News based in La Crosse, and she's with us now to talk about this story. Hope, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Hope, take us back to last year. What kind of flooding and what kind of damage did Western Wisconsin see?
Yeah, so we saw significant flash flooding towards the end of September last year that, you know, caused a lot of damage to public infrastructure. It was estimated around $11 million across around 10 counties. So it was pretty significant, mainly to roads, bridges, culverts, that sort of thing. There was also a lot of damage to private infrastructure.
And in terms of which towns in particular were hit the hardest, where was the damage focused?
There was a significant amount of damage in Vernon County that seemed to kind of get the brunt of things. In Vernon County alone, they had $5.2 million in public infrastructure damage. So those communities seemed to really get hit the hardest.
And this was coming up on a year ago, and you're reporting that the FEMA money to help these communities, it seems like in most cases, hasn't come in yet. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, so I talked to someone with Wisconsin Emergency Management about this issue, and you know, she said it's not uncommon for this process to take a year. It is a reimbursement process through FEMA. It's the public assistance program we're talking about. And after a region receives a federal disaster declaration, those communities are then eligible to be reimbursed for 75% of the cost to damage to public infrastructure and debris removal. But again, it's reimbursement. So those projects, those repairs have to take place first. And then there's a lengthy documentation process. And then that money is then delivered to those communities. So, you know, it's really just a matter of the communities fronting those costs to make the repairs and then waiting for the paperwork.
So this was obviously, in most cases, an unexpected expense for most of these towns and areas that were hit by this flooding. So is having to pay for this sort of repair and then wait for a check to come in, has that been a stretch for some communities financially?
It absolutely has. You know, I talked to the chair of the town of Fremont. That was one community in Clark County that saw a significant amount of damage. You know, they say they had to take that money out of the money they would have spent to gravel their roads this summer. They couldn't. They basically shortened that money for graveling and used it to repair the damage to their roads and culverts. I talked to Phil Hewitt, the highway commissioner in Vernon County. He said, you know, they were able to take that money out of what they would have used to, you know, re-blacktop roads or do other sort of scheduled maintenance. So it's definitely having an impact on these communities.
And in some cases, it sounds like there's some back and forth that's still going on, in particular over a bridge and whether or not the bridge can be repaired or replaced.
Yeah, this is a particular instance in Vernon County, a bridge that saw a significant amount of damage. You know, first estimates, Phil Hewitt in the highway commissioner thought that bridge was eligible to be completely replaced. Apparently, it's had issues with having flood damage in the past. But a second assessment found that the damage wasn't significant enough and that FEMA would only reimburse the county if they repair the bridge. And so this is just an example of kind of this paperwork, the regulations that, you know, some local officials are saying really slows down the process.
Can you give us a sense of how local officials are feeling about the wait? You said up top that this is not unusual for the aid to take this long to arrive, but how are officials feeling about that wait?
They're basically saying that, you know, this is an issue. You know, this process maybe needs to be looked at because it's not happening fast enough. And, you know, several of the people that I talked to said, you know, they're starting to lose faith that they're ever going to see that money. While they are very much appreciative that FEMA is willing to help them and that they receive this disaster declaration. This money could have a significant impact on in helping their communities. They just express frustration with having to wait so long, and in some cases, seeing another round of flood damage, another FEMA assessment coming through the area, and without ever seeing the funding from last year.
And it sounds like in the case of a new round of storms and some new repairs, not as extreme, but it sounds as though some officials are weighing whether or not it's worth the time to apply for this FEMA aid.
Right. So with the latest rounds of storms that we saw at the end of July, you know, FEMA's back in the area this week doing rounds of assessments. And again, I talked to Phil Hewitt in Vernon County, and he said that, you know, some local officials are asking why they're doing this again when they haven't even seen the money from last year. He's confident that they will see that funding, that FEMA is doing everything they can to get them their funding, to reimburse them from those costs. But it is a lengthy process from what I've heard. There is a significant amount of documentation, significant amount of back and forth to make sure the correct paperwork is in. And some local officials are wondering if it's a good use of their time.
And Hope, with FEMA in the area again, have officials made any sort of statement about the wait and about when it might arrive?
No, I haven't talked with any of the FEMA crews that are in the area this week. But, you know, again, just speaking with emergency management officials, you know, they said this isn't an uncommon situation, that, you know, it can be a burden for local officials to have to kind of front those damage repairs. But, you know, they just promoted the fact that they even receive a reimbursement, that this money does exist to help these communities and that they're not just stuck with the cost.
And talking to officials, Hope, do you get the sense that some of them might be looking ahead, realizing now that money from FEMA can take a while to process and to arrive, that they might build in more of a bad turn of phrase for this, but a rainy day fund into their budgets?
I haven't found out if they're kind of making any changes to the current budgets, but, you know, I did talk to Phil Hewitt again in Vernon County, said that he knows of some local governments that have had to borrow money to pay for last year's damage. And so, you know, they're in the process of making loan payments while still trying to keep up with maintenance. And that's not a good situation for some communities.
Hope, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Hope Kerwin is a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. She's based in La Crosse, and she joined us today for a look at the long wait for FEMA relief funds after last year's flooding in western Wisconsin.
Coming up, we'll hear about a Little League Baseball exchange program that's bringing kids from Puerto Rico to Milwaukee to learn, play, and experience Wisconsin. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, Trump TV, a quick highlight reel of positive news about the president, has media watchers asking, in some cases, whether it's propaganda. We'll look at presidential efforts to reach out to the public, past and present.
Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Imagine your spouse doesn't know you anymore. All the moments you shared, gone. Leota Esther tells us about the community that provided the support and stability that both she and her husband needed.
Although I lived in Wisconsin for 40 years, the 2 years that I hold closest to my heart are those that started every day with a walk into Brewster Village. Hidden from Appleton's nearby busy Wisconsin Avenue, but very present to those who've had and have loved ones living there. Once in, I would walk down the hall and greet those in the common room. Further down the hall, there he was, my husband Lee, waiting for me in the Alzheimer's wing. Through the curtains, I could see Lee rise out of his chair to greet me, a huge smile on his face. We'd go to his room, where he might have rearranged the furniture from the day before, where someone else's shirt might be hanging on his rack, and where pictures of his 3 daughters sat on his shelves. When he could still walk, we would go for a ride in the car. On the back roads, we marveled at cows, red barns, old faded signs, and corn high as his knee by the 4th of July. When we drove down the streets in town, he'd occasionally call out, "Hardee's," and point. But other than that, he never talked beyond a single word. Always, when we returned, staff and nurses greeted him, gave him a hug, saw him to the dinner table. This place had become his home, a home that offered the order that Alzheimer patients need, the daily structure of routine, a smooth transition from my love to include those who cared for him. When he had to be in a wheelchair, around the building we went, stopping to smell the one long-lasting white rose, listening to the birds in the not-too-distant trees, and especially singing. It is a gift that those with Alzheimer's can continue to sing the familiar words deep inside them, rising from their depths. Often we wheeled through the halls, where Lee greeted others with a cheerful, "Hi!" Sometimes he'd say, "Hi, Lee!" And we'd all smile. We were all family, healing, recovering, moving slowly to the end of life. I remember Lee's last days, when even then the nurses helped me bundle him up for a ride in the fresh air, when they pushed the piano to the hallway so that everyone in his area with ebbing memories and minds could hear opera tenor Dale Dusing sing to them. I remember, too, when they were by our sides as he died. When folks said, "How sad," as Lee was in the slow process of dying, I could say, "Yes." But it also gave us 2 years of a sweet love affair in a community that provided what we both needed.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton and the Francis A. and Georgia F. Ahrens Fund within the Brilliant Area Family of Funds. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now, 14 Milwaukee Little League baseball players traveled to Puerto Rico last summer for an education and cultural exchange experience. This year, Puerto Rico is sending some of their own to Milwaukee now to experience Wisconsin.
The program was started by Milwaukee baseball star Felix Montilla, who won a World Series with the Milwaukee Braves in 1957.
Felix's son Tony Montilla joins us now. He's an advisor to the Felix Montilla Little League Education and Cultural Exchange Program. Tony, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Thanks very much for having me.
Well, first off, tell us how the program works. What do the kids from Puerto Rico do when they come here to Milwaukee?
The program is really an education-based program with a little baseball thrown in for a little extra fun. So it is a 5-day extravaganza with the first full day. They came in on Thursday of last week, so that Friday all day was spent touring Milwaukee and giving them an insight into the city and exposing them to new and different things. So it was a jam-packed Friday. We started off with a boat tour of Milwaukee. It took us about an hour, and the kids were really enthralled with the bridge network that we had to go through to get out into into Lake Michigan. And as I thought about that, it's caught me by surprise because I didn't, until I thought about it, hadn't realized that these kids hadn't seen bridges, because bridges really don't exist on the island of Puerto Rico. So first time they saw, you know, roads moving in order for, you know, for a boat to go through. So that was kind of a highlight of that part of the trip. We then went from there to Discovery World and spent the better part of 3 or 3.5 hours with them exploring the aquarium and all of the other various things that Discovery World has. They spend a lot. They love the aquarium. You know, the opportunity to actually touch fish and to actually seem like you're in the world with the fish was amazing to them. We left there and went out to the Pettit Ice Arena, And Randy Dean and the folks out there were just awesome. They actually brought a bunch of pre-Olympian-type athletes in to give these kids some instruction. You know, they had never obviously been on ice before, and they had never had ice skates on. And we took them out there, and within 45 minutes, kids were skating. Lots of kids were falling. Parents were falling, but we had a fabulous time. And we left there and went over to the Harley Museum and had a, you know, guided tour of Harley, and that's how we ended day one.
That sounds great. A lot since then, I bet. I want to get into how this program started. Your dad, Felix, started this off. He played baseball for decades, including with the Milwaukee Braves. What led him to start this program?
Well, my dad got involved with a group of friends of his back in the early 70s, shortly after he had retired. They had recognized that there was no Little League on the near south side of Milwaukee for that community, and so they decided to start a league, and his friends wanted to name it after him, and he said okay to that, and he was involved pretty directly for probably a good 30 years, and then as he got up in age, he was less involved on a day-to-day basis, and the cultural exchange tour was something that I brought to Journey House, which is a nonprofit in Milwaukee, and they have been running the league for about 2 years, and I brought this to them as an idea to augment what they were already doing with the kids who were in the league from an education standpoint. So they were really magnificent in terms of their willingness to go along kind of with this wild idea to take kids from Milwaukee to Puerto Rico and in the following year bring kids from Puerto Rico to Milwaukee. So they said, go for it. If you can raise the dollars to get it done, we're happy to participate. And through the generosity of a lot of really good people in Milwaukee and beyond, we were able to raise the dollars to do both trips.
And talk about the community in Puerto Rico that the kids are coming from and then that the Milwaukee kids in alternate years are going to.
Well, we went to my father's hometown, which is a small town on the northwest coast in Puerto Rico, a town by the name of Isabela. Isabela is a small country town and not a town with a whole lot of income. You know, Puerto Rico is a poor island. This is a poor town on a poor island. So the kids there, for the most part, don't get many opportunities to, you know, get out of their town, much less leave the island. So it afforded them an opportunity to experience a lot of firsts, and that's what made the trip so special. And on the other end, on the other hand, with our kids in Milwaukee, it's pretty much the same story that, you know, many, many of them don't have opportunities to get out and travel. And so they, too, experience some of those same firsts, first time on an airplane, you know, first time for the kids in Milwaukee seeing an island, those kinds of things. So that's what we really wanted to do, to expose them to a series of firsts, to get them thinking about the greater world out there, their role in it. And as part of the process, we required of them, kind of the cost of admission, if you will, was for them to do some research on where they were going in the various, either Milwaukee or in Puerto Rico, to write a paper and then to deliver a 3-minute oral presentation relative to, you know, that particular activity or site that they researched. So they put a lot of time and energy into doing that. And what was really gratifying from the standpoint of the kids in Puerto Rico, some of the kids actually had the courage to do their speech in English. And as you know, English is not is clearly the second language there. So for those who had that that amount of courage, that was outstanding. And all of the kids participated in that. And then we had them journaling as we went on all the various activities to give us their thoughts and impressions relative to what they saw, what they learned, what they liked, what they didn't like, that sort of thing. So a really pretty intensive 5 days from an education standpoint.
I guess so.
Well,
and Tony, I want to ask, I know this is about education and new experiences. Can you talk about the value of baseball to and Little League to these kids, whether we're talking South Milwaukee or your father's hometown in Puerto Rico?
Well, you know, as with most kids, and it's primarily boys, when we went to Puerto Rico, we had one girl who was a member of our team, which kind of threw the folks in Puerto Rico for a loop. That was not something they had ever seen before, girls playing with the boys. But as you know, with most young boys in particular, if you ask them what do they want to be when they grow up, they oftentimes what you will hear is they want to be a professional athlete. Mm-hmm. If you're talking the kids in Puerto Rico, that is clearly baseball is king there. That's the sport they all want to play. Not as true in Milwaukee. You know, they've got basketball and soccer and football and other things as well. But baseball still is definitely high on the list of all the kids who play in the Little League. And my desire, quite frankly, was to, with respect to both sets of kids, is to acknowledge their desire to play pro. But to make sure they understand that the chances of them making that are very small. That's not to say don't try. Work hard, and your dream may come true. But if it doesn't come true, what is Plan B? And Plan B most often requires a certain amount of education, and it's why we're pushing this kind of this dual-track focus, education and baseball. And it's why we emphasize the education so much.
And Tony, just a few seconds left. I wanted to ask you, your dad, I understand, to kick off the event this year, gave you his 1957 Milwaukee Braves World Series ring. And just a few words, what was that like for you?
Super cool, super, super emotional. You know, my dad is not a real emotional guy, but he has a son who's very emotional. So it was a little bit teary in the house when he handed it over to me, and I wear it with great pride.
Tony, thank you so much for joining us and telling us about the program today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
That was Tony Montilla, advisor to the Felix Montilla Little League Education and Cultural Exchange Program.
Coming up after the news is pro-President Trump news outlet, potentially propaganda. We'll talk to a media expert about Trump TV. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll find out why a wave of former members of the Obama administration are currently running for office.
First, since his campaign last year, President Trump has slammed what he calls fake news, which he says has been putting out false and negative stories about him to the American people. Now, his campaign Facebook page, not the White House account, has started to produce new style videos which highlight positive news about the president.
Trump TV is hosted by a former pro-Trump CNN commentator, filmed in Trump Tower and produced by the president's daughter-in-law, Lara Trump. The way that Trump TV is produced and the stories it tells has some media analysts asking whether or not it veers into the territory of propaganda.
Margot Suska joins us now. She's a professor of journalism and mass communication at American University. Margot, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
And Margot, can you tell us in your words how you describe Trump TV?
Well, I think what we're waiting to hear is whether or not this is something that's being funded by the Republican National Committee or whether it's his reelection bid, but it is kind of low-quality produced online content coming through Facebook that is really very positive about Trump, including headlines, you know, about positive economic news and things are going great. I think if you were to watch Trump News Network through Facebook, you would think you were living in a different country.
Let's listen to a little bit of it.
Hey, everybody, I'm Kaylee McEnany. Thank you for joining us as we provide you the news of the week from Trump Tower here in New York. More great economic news on Friday. The July jobs report added a better-than-expected 209,000 jobs. Overall, since the president took office, President Trump has created more than 1 million jobs. The unemployment rate is at a 16-year low, and consumer confidence is at a 16-year high, all while the Dow Jones continues to break records.
That was Kayleigh McEnany, former CNN commentator, Republican commentator there. And she is the voice of Trump TV. What do you hear in that particular clip, Margo?
Well, I mean, for one, the production, the music in the background, right? This is, you know, some very patriotic sounding news. And what I hear from that is not that I'm against it, not that I'm against the content, or not that I'm against positive economic news that's being linked to the Trump administration. But as a professor of journalism and as a former practicing journalist, what's missing from that is any context. There's any multiple perspectives or multiple viewpoints, right? Administrations, public officials, whether at the federal level or at the state or the local level, don't get to just have their message be unchecked, right? That's the role of journalism, to make sure that things are fact-checked, verified, accurate, and to provide some context. What's missing from that is, you know, or any of those, you know, perspectives. Where is there a voice from an economist, a conservative economist, or even a more liberal economist? Right? I mean, it can't just be a pretty blonde reading Trump headlines from Trump Tower.
How is this different than, say, the fireside chats of Roosevelt or Ronald Reagan's carefully, beautifully staged public events that he is known for? How is it different from a president like that going around the media and or using the media to some extent to get their message across in a way that they design?
I think that's an excellent question. And really, in many ways, it is not any different, right? And it is not, you could also say it's not any different than propagandistic messages that governments have used since, you know, for decades and decades. So where is that line? And I think these are questions that we've been asking since we found out about Trump News Network. Where is that line between a well-crafted public relations image, right, President Obama going on the Ellen show to talk about health care? Where is that line between this well-crafted public relations message and what we might consider veering into propagandistic territory? And I think what's troubling to me about this is that at the same time that you have these messages, what you didn't have from Roosevelt, what you didn't have from Ronald Reagan, is an all-out assault on the mainstream media. So what you have from Trump is this every day beating this drum of fake news and, you know, the horrible New York Times and CNN. And then what he's giving now is this alternative. And I think that's what makes this a little bit different than these well-crafted public messages that we've seen from other leaders in the United States.
And we didn't hear the end of that segment of Trump TV. It ends with Kayleigh McEnany saying, "And that's the real news." And so does that get at that territory you're talking about where, you know, we start disputing what, you know, is a fact and what isn't a fact?
Yeah, absolutely. And for me, that's my concern. And listen, the United States of America is bigger than Donald Trump. And I think that that's what my concern is that this drumbeat every day of anti-mainstream media, which is clearly having an effect, but we need a free and independent press in the United States. That's one of the foundations and hallmarks of our democracy. What's the long-term effect going to be in 10 or 20 years when you have this level of government delegitimizing and constantly tearing down the media and the press? What does that mean for the trust of mainstream news organizations and the public that really relies on them to tell stories, to give voice to the voiceless? What is that concern going to be? You know, that's the concern for me, is what is this going to be long term? What is the effect going to be, not just on the press, but I think on the public that in a democracy?
We're talking right now to Margo Suska about Trump TV. It's an online service on President Trump's campaign Facebook page, which promotes positive stories about the president. And Margo, the era that we live in, there's media saturation. There's hundreds of outlets. There are bloggers. There's Twitter. In a sense, when we worry about listeners wondering what's true and what isn't, whether something is context, whether it doesn't, is that getting maybe a little paternalistic? Do we live in an era where it's sort of buyer beware? If you're someone who consumes news, you have to assume that you have to do some background checking, and maybe you have to look for different sources on your own.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that it can't all be on the back of journalists. And I think that, you know, the public, this in a democracy, the public has to do some work too, right? We have a responsibility as well. But I think that we have to remember that these charges of fake news are coming at a time when the media is the least trusted that it's been in 40 years of Gallup asking about media trust, right? Pew reports are constantly saying that the public has a massive distrust for the media. And I don't know that it's just a distrust. I think that there's also a disconnect between media elites in Washington, of course, where I am, and New York City, and many people in the United States. I just don't know that we're telling the kinds of stories that are resonating with the public. And I think that that's an issue, right? So I think that there are a lot of news outlets, but, you know, we should be in a democracy. We should be reading more than just one-sided views that conform to our own beliefs. And, you know, maybe for some of us, we've got to be willing to pay for it as well. But I understand why people stopped paying for news. They stopped paying for their local newspaper when it was more advertising than it was strong local government reporting. I understand what happened, but I think that, you know, there is a little bit of responsibility on the part of the public to choose sources, but on the part of media organizations as well. We need to get back to putting content over profit, and I think that's a huge issue as well.
Is one of the questions here whether or not this works for President Trump, whether it's successful in reaching a huge audience and getting his message out? Do we have any inkling about how successful it is or could be?
Well, certainly, I would think that we should probably want to know how he would define successful in his mind. And I am curious whether or not this is an aim, a profit-motivated aim for him. Perhaps if he loses the White House in 2020, is this going to be a revenue stream for Trump? You know, let's not forget that big news conglomerates and media conglomerates make billions of dollars a year. NBC Universal reported in January, I think, $1.7 billion with a B in operating cash flow. So if Trump can get in on some of that action, hey, that's one thing, and that's you know maybe if he's looking at us as a revenue source. But if this is if we're going to measure success, or if the Trump team is going to measure success in whether or not the wall gets built, or whether or not the alt-right or white supremacists continue to be emboldened in this country, well, that's something that I think we need to look at and examine a little more closely.
Does the mainstream media have any responsibility here? This is something new. As you said, we don't know how President Trump himself would define success, but is there any sort of response that you think would be welcome from established news outlets?
Well, I think it's interesting because when you saw the reports coming out about Trump and the media efforts, I think his daughter-in-law is involved in the project. What happens is anytime that you have any story that's going to come out that even mentions it, you give Trump the opportunity to call it fake news or, just to criticize it. So I think, that's interesting. But again, what I love about this country right now is that you're really seeing late-night television hosts kind of take on, take on a role of mainstream media. I think that Stephen Colbert called it state-sponsored propaganda, if I'm not mistaken. So I think there are some voices who are getting through, and I hope that those voices are going to be louder than this one-sided media.
Margo Suska is with us right now. We were talking about Trump TV. It's an online service that promotes positive stories about President Trump.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you checked out the Trump TV videos? If so, what did you think of them? What do you think of this idea? Do you think it is a solid and reasonable way for a president to reach out directly to the public without the media filter getting in the way? Or do you worry that it borders on, leads into propaganda? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll pick up our conversation in just a little bit here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And right now we are continuing our conversation about the new Trump TV channel on YouTube and whether or not it can be considered propaganda or just a way for the president to get past the media filter and reach out directly to the public. Our guest is journalism and mass communications professor Margot Suska of American University.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this idea? What do you think? Have you seen them of the Trump TV videos? Good idea? Harmless? Or are you worried that it's starting to blur the lines with propaganda? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll take our first caller right now. We have Zaki in Zion, Illinois. Zaki, hi.
How you doing?
Good, thanks.
I just want to say that the whole Trump news thing, that is propaganda. I will say that. But I also want to speak as an African-American growing up in the American culture, the way we've always viewed the news. And, you know, to me, for what I've learned, the news has been propaganda for years for different people who had access to the reporters, who had access to the newspapers and the editors and all that. So to me, you know, that's not really, you know, a big surprise. And I think Donald Trump is coming along. And I even look at the things that Barack Obama did, you know, clamping down on reporters and just doing things against the media. And I think Trump is just following up. And I just think it's bad to just have a channel, you know, where it's just going to talk about the, you know, the good things about you. That's like fascism, if I got it correctly. That's,
and Zaki, thanks for breaking up a little there at the end. I really appreciate your thought there. Zaki having a couple points. He says, for an African-American in this society, the voices of power were to him propaganda, having all of the access and all of the say, all of the airtime. And also he does think that this Trump TV looks like propaganda to him. What do you think of those comments?
Well, I think that it's when I think of propaganda, the definition that I use in class, the definition that I use in my research for the last decade, really is a deliberate and systematic spread of facts for one aim, right? So that's to sway a group to behave or to act or to think a certain way. So I'm not sure that I would consider the mainstream media propaganda. I think that some scholars have considered it an arm of propaganda by political elites. So, you know, certainly I think it's worth noting, and you would find research that agrees with that. But when I think of propaganda, I think of it as how someone with power is trying to influence people to think and behave in a way that they may not be aware of the aims of that source. And I think of, you know, American propaganda during World War II. We had an Office of War Information. No conversation, you know, about propaganda can start without a discussion of Nazi propaganda in the run-up to the Holocaust.
Do you think that what President Trump is doing is simply following, taking the next steps in a pattern that former President Barack Obama already started? This is maybe the natural next step?
Well, I think that I've been critical of Barack Obama and his role in prosecuting leakers and in kind of rolling back press freedom in a way that other administrations hadn't. I don't know that I would call what he was doing propaganda. So I'm not sure it's what he started. You know, the internet and social media have just taken off in such a way that I think no one could have seen where we are now. And with the Trump tweeting himself every day or every few days. And I think that when you talk about propaganda, there is one element of it that's at the, you know, I think at the forefront, and that's the spectacle. And I think no one understands spectacle better than Donald Trump.
Zaki, thanks a lot for those thoughts. And we're going to go next to John in Greendale. John, hello.
Hi. I was calling. I wanted to give my perspective on Trump's new state-run television that he's going to be having. And back in 92, I believe, when Bill Clinton took office, they had talk radio started the big boom. I think there were like 600 radio stations throughout the country getting faxed from Newt Gingrich and until we start, now there's, 1600? Or there's so many multiple more talk radio networks that are spewing Republican propaganda. And until, I guess, we recognize that, it's going to just continue to, we can't just keep saying, well, we should look for other opinions, or the news is the news. And if I remember from 92 when I sat and listened and watched what was happening with the health care at that time and the crime bill, it was reported in like USA Today what was going on with their votes in the government, in the Senate, and passing, and who voted for it. Those are the facts, and that's what. And then you listen to talk radio tell you how bad it was, or how it wasn't going to do this, your money was going to fly away.
John, thank you so much for sharing that. And he says this is pretty much what talk radio does right now.
Well, I think a hallmark of propaganda, again, is a distortion or an exaggeration of facts. So I think that the caller in that case is right on.
John, thanks a lot for that call. As we talk right now with Margot Suska, professor of journalism and mass communication at American University, talking about Trump TV, a short news feature with positive stories, produced at Trump Tower by a relative of the president, and featuring only that one perspective. And we'll go now to Elena in Milwaukee. Elena, hi.
Hi. I wanted to say that we have seen from the very, very beginning, starting with the size of the inaugural crowd, that this president doesn't value the truth or what is real. So he's going to present everything that makes him look good. And if someone shows you who they are, Maya Angelou said, believe them. So everything that he says has been fact-checked, 70% are not true. So I wouldn't believe anything he had on his radio, on his television station.
Elena, thank you for that. And looking again at that aspect of facts, and there was the famous alternative facts statement from Kellyanne Conway. Do you think that the American public is learning about, is getting an education in the media and in context at this particular point in history, Margot?
I would say that I hope so, and I'm thrilled that the mainstream media has, since the election, has really increased resources to cover the administration and to cover the president, and I think that's wonderful news for the public in a democracy. But I think that we're just becoming so fractured as an electorate, and not just as media consumers, but in political parties, that I think I'm wondering what's going to be able to unite us again and what's going to be able to bring us back. And I think the caller is right, alternative facts, and you had people then defending that. Maybe this week or this last week we're going to see some separation between conservative voices and Trump voices, and I think that we've, the last 8 months or so, we've conflated conservatism with Trumpism, and now I think what we've seen since Charlottesville are Republicans coming out saying, I don't think these viewpoints represent, of this administration, represent my brand of conservatism. And I think that's, maybe that's a starting point.
And Margot, as we talk about the impact of this, and you say a danger you're seeing is everyone is getting so fractured, and it gets harder to get things done, it gets harder to unite around things and to have people moving forward together and elected officials moving forward together as one. Are you concerned about the long-term effects? If things continue in a way that you think is unhealthy, what's the end of the road look like?
I wish that I could say. I mean, my concern as a media scholar and as a journalism educator, my concern is there is great journalism being done every single day at the local level, at the state level, and at the national level. And I want to make sure that people are willing to pay for that and that, subscribe to your local newspaper and, watch your local television station. And it's more than just finding the blogger online who you agree with, right? But I also think that news companies need to be willing to pay their reporters, and they need to be willing to pay to staff these local and state news organizations to give the kind of coverage that people are willing to pay for, and that's essential. You know, I'm training the next generation of journalists, and I'm extremely hopeful for what kinds of work they'll be able to do in the communities that they'll be able to cover. But I hope that they have an audience that is willing to understand that they're in it for them, right? Not as a spokesperson for a public official, and not to blast a public official either.
Margot, thank you so much for joining us. That was Margot Suska, professor of journalism and mass communication at American University, joining us today to talk about Trump TV. Good news for fans of the distant future and space dogs and flying car spaceship thingies. Variety is reporting that a live-action pilot of the TV show The Jetsons is on order for ABC.
If you're too young to remember, The Jetsons was originally a Hanna-Barbera cartoon set decades, centuries maybe, in the future. It featured the antics of George, Jane, Elroy, and Judy Jetson, along with their robot maid Rosie and their dog Astro.
The TV show featured cool tech like video phones, flying cars, and food pellets. But we kind of already have video phones now, and we almost have self-driving cars.
On the list of things that I think the world needs, the pop culture world needs, live-action Jetsons was not really high up there. Are you?
Well, you can't see it coming. You wouldn't have asked for it, but that doesn't mean you're not going to want it.
Doesn't mean I don't need it?
Now that I know about it, I would watch it once.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it'll be interesting to see how they pull off the flying cars, I guess. I guess the special effects are cool. The humor is updated. Yeah, I'm probably still not going to watch.
And you can't beat the theme song. Meet George Jetson.